This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. We'll begin today with a story that we meant to be about a priest who was the director of an ailing soccer team and what he did to revive it and how that worked out for the fellow he hired to help with the reviving, who's a guy you've heard of if you follow English football. But then it kind of started to become a story about a man and his dog.
Well, my name is Father Joe Young. I'm a Catholic priest in the Diocese of Limerick in Ireland.
And who's that in the background?
That's my dog, Moses.
Moses?
Yeah.
It's a bit Old Testament.
I know, yeah. Oh, he's a good boy.
Father Joe and I spoke on the telephone, which is technology we don't often use since it doesn't sound so good on the radio, but...
I'm the only priest in the diocese that doesn't have a computer. It's, you know, we've got to be with the days when we would sit down and have a cup of tea together, you know?
I did know, and I do. So Father Joe and I talked on, never mind the dog and the telephone, and we talked about how back in 1989, Father Joe took on a job that wouldn't seem to have had a thing to do with his vocation.
Well, basically, it just happened on one Friday night that Limerick Football Club was in serious difficulty. There was a real possibility that it was going to fold up, you know. I was approached by those involved with the board at the time. Would I come in as chairman to see if I could, keep it alive? And I agreed without thinking.
I love it. Do you think it's possible that Moses could be given a biscuit or something?
Well, I'm doing my very best here.
I understand.
There's somebody out in the back, and he's playing his role.
He's protecting you. That's understandable.
Yeah.
Throughout the call, there was, as it happens, no danger out back, though Moses continued to feel otherwise. But back to the story. Father Joe took on the job of the Limerick Club because it wasn't just a football club that needed reviving. In those days, Limerick was a dangerous and violent place. To say the burg had earned its nickname, Stab City, might be an exaggeration, but it might not. The new director realized that to revitalize the football club, he'd need a manager, even if he didn't have enough money to pay him.
So I basically got a list of player managers that, you know, were not in employment at the time. And I just basically picked up the phone one night and I said, I'll give this a shot.
Father Joe called Sam Allardyce, who'd played for West Bromwich Albion, the English team Father Joe had once followed and fancied. He remembered Allardyce had done a stint as an assistant coach as well.
He answered the phone, and he believed it was actually a friend of his from another football club and thought that I was winding him up, you know.
You mean he thought it was a prank?
He did, yeah, totally.
Beautiful.
I won't say what he actually said on the air, you know.
I appreciate that very much, Father.
Thank you.
Whatever Sam Allardyce said, he didn't mean it. Father Joe's dream of a revived team in Limerick appealed to him, perhaps because at 36, Allardyce hadn't much time left as a player anyway, and his job as an assistant coach had been eliminated for lack of funds. What else had he to do? Still, Father Joe wasn't sure showing Allardyce Limerick's beat-up pitch was a good idea, at least right off.
I brought him to the local rugby field, you know. There's a history of rugby in Limerick, which is known far and wide, you know. And there was a beautiful pitch in Tumen Park, and I said, have a look at that, Sam. And he said, God, that's great. Well, I said, that's what it looked like when we're finished. Now I'll show you the real field.
Oh, and was he terribly disappointed to see the real field?
Well, he was, and at the same time, he was a bit of a dreamer like myself, you know.
Thus, Father Joe sold his dream, and Sam Allardyce bought it, and shortly thereafter, he went to work.
Ah, he was brilliant. You see, he was absolutely, totally purpose-driven. He had a vision. He applied it. He worked at it. He was the most brilliant manager that I ever saw in this side of the water, you know.
In a year, Allardyce had Limerick FC back in Ireland's top division. Fans started to return. The pitch would be improved. And as Father Joe told the Telegraph in London, the new coach gave the youth of Limerick a reason to get up in the morning, to believe there was more to life than sleeping and taking drugs. The rookie head coach's success did not go unnoticed. Sam Allardyce began getting calls from back home in England, from clubs that would actually pay him a living wage to do what he'd done for Limerick FC. Father Joe says he wept when Allardyce was hired away and that Allardyce wept a little as well.
I'm sorry about my dog, but anyway.
That's all right. I love your dog.
I hope we've been able to have this conversation. You wouldn't mind, but you'd swear he was a German Shepherd. You could put him into me pocket.
Over the next 15 years, Allardyce moved from club to club, landing at one point with West Ham United, where he honored the priest who'd enabled him to take charge of a team for the first time.
He made me honorary chaplain there, you know?
Yeah.
But I couldn't be chaplain thing then, because I don't think that would fit in now with my accent and with the fact that I love the Irish team.
That's a shame, because this week, Sam Allardyce was named manager of England's men's team.
Well, I said, look, Sam, the dream has come true. The field has arrived. You're on the biggest field now in the world. And I said, don't forget, we started on a very, very small piece of grass. And I promised him that he'll always be in my daily prayers and mass.
Sam Allardyce may need the prayers. Though England takes credit for inventing the game, their men's national side has been disappointing almost forever. But if anybody can revive them, perhaps it's Allardyce, at least according to Father Joe. Though, truth be told, he'll be relieved when the fuss over Sam's appointment subsides.
It's been very difficult to be able to say mass with all the calls I've been getting, one. I'm finding it hard to work on my prayer life.
I took the hint and offered to end the call, but Father Joe wouldn't hear of it without bringing us around to the place where our conversation had begun.
I'll tell Moses now one thing. He's been on American radio, and maybe that'll make him quiet.
Maybe it will, and maybe it won't. And even if it doesn't, I'll be delighted to talk with Father Joe Young anytime, especially if his former coach one day does for England what he did a while back for Limerick. When I was a child, I collected baseball cards, but I wasn't serious about it. I clipped some of them to the spokes of my bicycle because they made a great noise. I flipped a lot of them with my friends, which meant I bent them in the middle and that they landed in the dust of the playground. And sometimes, if there was a dispute over who'd called odds or evens, they got stepped on. Lucas Stahlbaumer, who works as a lab engineer at an aviation company, also enjoyed collecting baseball cards when he was a kid. But he was serious about it, and he remembers the first time he thought, albeit briefly, that the hobby might pay off.
Well, I was in either second or third grade, and a kid came up and said that he'd give $20 for Ken Griffey Jr. card. So I went home and rummaged through all my baseball cards, and I found one. But it was a 91 Topps card, and when I brought it to him to school and showed it to him, he's like, no, that ain't it. Then he walked away.
The kid who walked away wanted a 1989 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. Lucas didn't know why that card was special to the kid or to anybody else, at least not yet. But another child in his circumstances back in the second or third grade might have been discouraged. Another child might have walked away from his baseball card collection and allowed it to gather dust in the corner of his closet until his mother threw it away. In which case, the story of Lucas Stahlbaumer's baseball card collection would be the same as mine. But that's not the way it worked out, because for whatever reason, Lucas Stahlbaumer, now 33, kept thinking about that 1989 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card and the smiling fellow it featured.
Well, after I heard about him, I did all sorts of research and other things on him, like book reports, whenever we had to write a paper and that sort of thing. And I learned how great of a player he actually was and all the things that he could do.
One of the things Ken Griffey Jr. did was serve as the inspiration for what became this especially significant baseball card. But I'm getting ahead of myself. When he was in high school, Lucas acquired the card he hadn't had when he was a little kid. He paid $56 for it on eBay, and when it arrived, he was not disappointed.
To me, it's just simplicity. It's just his smiling face, the blue hat, and his smile. Of course, it's the 1989 Upper Deck, which was the game changer of all the cards. You got the hologram on the back, so the card can't be counterfeited. So it was a complete game changer for the entire industry.
And as it would turn out, for Lucas, who would keep buying. The monetary value of a 1989 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, like the value of any other card, or the value of a share of stock in General Electric, for that matter, can be calculated day to day. It was probably especially high last week when Ken Griffey Jr. was inducted into the Hall of Fame. But what about the non-monetary value? The non-monetary value of a share of GE stock is probably nil, right? Not so with a Ken Griffey Jr. card, at least if you're Lucas Stahlbaumer.
Yeah, they're kind of like my little babies. That sounds weird, but I'm attached to them. I'm addicted to them. I just like them or love them, I guess.
How many have you got as we speak?
Well, I got 312, I think, that are raw and like two or four that are graded. And I got three unopened cases, which there's about 20 to 60 in each case. Like two.
Just to skip ahead a bit, Stahlbaumer has at least 400 and perhaps as many as 500 Ken Griffey Jr. Upper Deck rookie cards.
Two unopened sets and one open set.
Is there a special room in your house for all this?
Yeah, I got one bedroom just dedicated to cards.
And a little annex in the bedroom for Ken Griffey Jr. cards, I guess.
Yeah, one big corner.
Stahlbaumer does not own all of the 1989 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards. He estimates as many as 2 million were made, which leaves a lot of room for his collection to grow.
I got three bedrooms I could fill up if I wanted to, I guess.
And so ends the story of a fellow who, back when he was in the second or third grade, didn't have the right card. Now he's got so many of them, he doesn't know exactly how many he's got, and neither does anybody else, and he's not selling them, and nobody's throwing them away. And if Ken Griffey Jr. is listening, now he knows the identity of his biggest fan, or at least the biggest fan of his 1989 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. Does Ken Griffey Jr. know you're doing this?
Not that I know of. I've never met him or talked to him. I'd like to meet him someday, though. That'd be pretty cool.
You see why I hope Ken Griffey Jr. is listening, right? Because if he and Lucas were ever to sit down together in that room full of Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards, wouldn't it be fun to see which of them was the more astonished? Visit onlyagame.org to find a link to an excellent Vice Sports story about Lucas Stahlbaumer and his collection. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider rating us on iTunes and leaving a review. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Even in July, we're never far from football season. That sport is the first subject we'll tackle. It's funny, because in this week's three stories you should know. Joining me again this time around are the Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and Sports on Earth's Will Leach via Skype. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
An honor as always.
I'm going to start us off this week. The National Football League has been promoting and funding a program called Heads Up Football. The program is designed not only to educate coaches, but, and I think probably primarily, to encourage parents to allow their kids to play football. The program has claimed that it reduces injuries by 76% and concussions by about 30%, and the New York Times has reviewed these figures, and here's the big surprise, they're wrong. Heads Up Football has not reduced concussions at all. The independent company that performed the study has taken the blame for not informing the NFL, which I'm sure had no idea. Anyway, without getting into who is responsible for the misrepresentation of the effectiveness of the program, I just wonder if it's time to acknowledge that football is a violent sport in which players are likely to get their heads banged around, and we should perhaps also acknowledge that the NFL is even more desperate than previously supposed to promote the game as safer. I'm going to stop listening to them when they say that. Will, what about you?
I think we all probably need to be able to acknowledge that basic fact that the game is a violent game. And it's funny, players tend to acknowledge this.
Absolutely.
But philosophically speaking, the league can't do it, and they never will. And to me, that's the ugly part of the part of programs like Heads Up. It is wrapped in this notion that, like, oh no, this is making the game safer. We're doing everything that we can. The problem is, we've discussed this before here, I feel like I spend all off season being like, guys, NFL is really dangerous. And then the game starts, no one remembers.
It seems like people just don't seem to care. They don't seem to care that football is dangerous. Here's an example. One would think that with all the research coming out about its dangers, that the numbers of participation in youth tackle football would be plummeting. And that's not the case.
They have gone down a little bit, right?
They have gone down a little bit, but not in recent years, not in the last year, according to most recent data. And what has gone up sharply is participation in what else? An NFL-operated league called NFL Flag for kids. Mm-hmm. And this is flag football. It's not tackle. But I think what that does is kind of keep people excited about football. These kids wear jerseys of NFL teams. People just love football. It's very hard for this country to quit the sport.
Flag football is gateway drug.
That appears to be what's happening, yes.
It's also worth remembering, you know, that Bloomberg had a study about this last year where they talked about how among more wealthier families, that is where participation is going down. But those wealthy families aren't not watching the game. So basically it turns the NFL into a little bit like the military, that like, hey, listen, I don't want my kids to go play, but I would definitely encourage other people's kids to go play.
Will, you're up next, and I understand you've been thinking about a certain rookie pitcher this week, and it must have been painful.
The St. Louis Cardinals on Sunday, they had to use a spot starter named Mike Mayers. He's actually not a top Cardinals prospect. It just happened to be his turn in the rotation, and the Cardinals had a doubleheader during the week, so they had to use a Triple-A pitcher. Unfortunately for him, it happened to be on Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN when everyone was watching against the Los Angeles Dodgers. So Mike Mayers is out there getting national television attention. There's his family. They're so cute. They're so happy. And he gave up 9 runs in 1 1/3 inning.
Ooh.
8 hits, 2 walks. He was, in fact, the first pitcher in Major League Baseball history to give up 9 or more earned runs in less than 2 innings in his Major League debut. He's really not a major prospect, which brings up the very real possibility this could be like a Brooklyn Robins pitcher from 1918 named Harry Heitman, who he pitched in one game. He faced 4 batters. All 4 of them got hits. After the game, he showered, took off his uniform, and joined the Navy. And never pitched again. So I don't know if that what Mike Mayers is going to do, but certainly it's something to keep in mind.
He did get some people out, so his ERA is not infinite.
Yes, thank heavens for small blessings.
Rachel, what do you think?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about this to me is just the family's reaction, because, you know, the only thing worse than being in sort of a 10-run rule situation, as many of us who've played sports have been in, is having witnesses, not only on live TV, but in person, you know, family members you grew up with. It reminded me of the reaction of the Olympic gymnast Ali Raisman's family in London in the 2012 Olympics. NBC showed her parents just contorting and cringing in the stands as she went through her routine. I feel for his family, and it sounds like ESPN eventually cut away, which was the merciful thing to do.
Yes, it was.
You know, I wonder, Will, if we should have even brought this up, because as Rachel mentioned, there is a rule in many leagues called the mercy rule. I played in a fast-pitch softball league for many years. There was a mercy rule.
Yes,
the quality of mercy may have dictated that we not even bring this guy up. But as long as we did, hey, he made it to the major leagues.
Absolutely.
How many people can say that? So that's not too bad, right?
Absolutely. He's always got that. And unfortunately, in an age of ESPN with ads to sell, the mercy rule is just never going to cut it, as much as we would have loved to have had that opportunity.
All right, Rachel, you're next. But first, full disclosure, I did have a cup of coffee in preparation for this conversation.
As did, in fact, I had 2, Bill, so I'm one up on you there. Of course, the latest in a very long line of doping scandals in sports is Russia. Depending on how this shakes out, maybe a fourth to a third of the Russian Olympic team will not compete in the Rio Olympics that start next month. But there's a little known, maybe among the general public, fact that many, many elite athletes, including Olympians, willingly partake in a proven performance-enhancing substance. What I'm talking about, of course, is caffeine. Now, this is something that actually used to be on the banned list until 2004. And at that point, I think the World Anti-Doping Agency just quit and said, you know what, we can't control this. There are too many espressos in the world. Do what you want. But nonetheless, study after study shows that caffeine confers about a 1-2% performance benefit for many people. In Olympic sports, especially some measured in fractions of a second, this is a significant benefit. But it does highlight the sometimes blurry line between things that are banned and things that are legal.
Will, you strike me as a highly caffeinated sort of person. What do you make of this?
Actually, my dirty secret, Bill, is I don't drink coffee at all. Can you imagine if I did? But I don't. I'd like to note the number of columns that have been blasting Mark McGwire or Barry Bonds or Dee Gordon or Maria Sharapova have all been written by journalists who are heavily PED users, if we are using caffeine as an idea. That's why I never liked the term performance-enhancing drug, because like there's an argument that like a good back rub is a PED. It certainly feels that way for me writing sometimes.
Or an aspirin. I mean, if you have a headache and you take a couple aspirin and the headache goes away, you've enhanced your performance.
I've always thought LASIK eye surgery is like a perfect example of this.
Excellent. Mm-hmm.
We all decide that LASIK is, even though it's like by definition going in and changing your body chemistry to make you improve something, particularly in something like baseball, as eyesight's so important in that, that line has always been very confusing.
Well, I just need to say that if coffee does reappear on the IOC's banned list, it will mark the end of my Olympic aspirations, and that will be very sad. Rachel, have we taken this sufficiently seriously for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a little silly, really.
And for what it's worth, most of the writers that I know that have a real caffeine problem do, in fact, use syringes. Maybe the syringe is the point where you've gone over the line.
Well, it's faster, and we have deadlines.
Exactly.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
In my four decades covering sports, I've learned that when athletes tell you about the 3 minutes and 41 seconds that fueled their success, they're usually talking about a race or a game. Maybe they set a track record and caught the attention of sponsors. Perhaps they suddenly and temporarily discovered the secret to defending Kobe Bryant. They're not usually talking about listening to a podcast for the first time, and that's how this next story is different. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Our story begins not with success, but with failure. Since graduating from Brown in 2015, Anders Weiss has been rowing with the U.S. national team. One day, back in May, he was training in Princeton, New Jersey, hoping for a spot on the men's eight, when his coach walked up to him and said,
"Can I speak to you in the office?" And I was like, "Oh, no, I don't want to hear that ever." And he said, "Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I don't think you're not going to be in the eight. This is the end of the road for you." That was sort of a shocker, but it actually worked out very well.
By some measures, things had already worked out well for Anders Weiss. Rowers don't usually peak until their late 20s or early 30s. Anders is only 23, so when he first started training with the team, he was really seen as a prospect for 2020. Still, Anders was devastated. His coach told him that he had one last shot to make it to Rio. He needed to qualify to row pairs at the trials in June. But before starting over again, new boat, new tactics, new teammate, Anders decided to take a few days off and drive from New Jersey to Rhode Island to see his family and his girlfriend.
I was not in the best of mindsets, and I said, I cannot listen to music for 4 hours on a good trip, and you know, coming through Connecticut usually adds another hour or two. And I said, I can't listen to music anymore. I need something else to distract me. A friend in college said, you know, I always listen to podcasts. And I said, all right, I'll check this out. So opened up the podcast app on my phone and I said, all right, this one looks like it'd be entertaining.
No, the podcast wasn't National Public Radio's award-winning sports program. The program is called Freakonomics, and it's produced by our friends down at WNYC. Freakonomics explores what it calls the riddles of everyday life and the weird wrinkles of human nature. And the riddle Freakonomics took on in the episode that just happened to pop up on Anders' podcast app, how to be more productive.
How to be more productive is something I want to do. And so I said, all right, I'm going to listen to that one.
Anders just happened to discover Freakonomics in time for Self-Improvement Month, and listeners were calling in with their personal goals.
Learn to knit a scarf and try new ethnic foods.
I most definitely want to up my guitar playing skills.
I want to read my 2-year-old to sleep every night and also take my wife to the movies from time to time.
I'd like to become a better American.
None of the Freakonomics listeners, not a single one, said they'd like to row for the U.S. Olympic team. But it wasn't talk about goal setting that would put Anders Weiss on the road to Rio. It was when Freakonomics host Stephen Dubner paused briefly to ask his guest, author Charles Duhigg, about motivation.
And I wonder if you could talk for a minute about how control plays into motivation. In other words,
Duhigg explained that there are two types of motivation, internal and external. Let's imagine two students are studying for the same test. Both might spend the same amount of time studying, but the first student believes that the test is primarily a measure of how smart he is. So he studies, because that's what you do, but his studying is not very productive. That's external motivation, the belief that his success isn't entirely in his control. The other student believes that her test score will be a result of how hard she studies, not how smart she is. And that is entirely in her control. So when she really studies. Duhigg explained that this kind of internal motivation leads to much better results. That's something 23-year-old Anders Weiss just hadn't figured out yet.
I put a lot of work in athletics. It wasn't, oh, I'm so talented, I'm going to just lie on the couch. I still did all the work, but that work to me wasn't work to win. It was work to showcase my talent.
This is a really small distinction, but it's important. Anders was working hard. He was talented, but so was everyone else. And this podcast and the science behind it was telling him that if he believed he was in control of how quickly he could move the boat, if he didn't give in to the idea that his top speed was limited by his genetics, he could work even harder and the work he put in would be more productive. This idea might have been new to Anders, but Charles Duhigg told Freakonomics that it's something that the U.S. Marine Corps figured out a while ago.
The Corps as a whole never tells anyone that there's such a thing as natural-born leaders, because that implies that you don't have any control over whether you're a leader or not. Instead, what they do is they compliment shy people who take a leadership role. And they say to them, look, I know it was hard for you to do that, but you did a great job.
And that's it. 3 minutes and 41 seconds, and the podcast moved on.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how to make to-do lists that really work.
It's a very small part of it, yeah. Once that segment came up, that was sort of all I thought about for the rest of the car ride. I was thinking the entire car ride, wow, I really actually genuinely thought that talent was all I needed, and it's not. I was just like, wow, I'm an absolute idiot for thinking that my entire life.
So what did Anders do with this newfound knowledge? Did he rush back to Princeton and tell his new rowing partner, Nara Gregian, what he had learned?
No, I didn't want to tell him that. It makes me look like a bum to him. You know, it was a new partnership. I said, I am not going to mention this one bit. I'm just going to see, you know, if it actually works and if this mindset actually helps.
And did it help?
Boy, oh God, did it help.
Okay, so what did it change for you out there on the water days after days?
Oh, it made the steady state actually, it makes it meaningful when you're spending so much time doing the same thing over and over again, because that's what rowing is. I mean, you're taking the same stroke over and over and over again for, you know, 3-4 hours a day. It helps pass the time because you're saying to yourself, this is why I'm going to win. We got so much faster. It was shocking how much faster we got.
Anders says that in the 6 weeks he and Narag trained for the trials together, they made more gains in speed than Anders had made in the previous 8 months. And by the time the trials came around in June, the pair was ready.
Narag and I mean, I don't even think we were in anyone's top three or top four or top five even. But we knew how fast the other teams were, and we knew how fast we had gotten. And we said to ourselves, you know, let's win every race.
Let's go, Anders!
Right now!
Yes, go!
Go!
Let's go!
Anders and Narag didn't win every race. They won almost every race. And most importantly, they won the race that counts, the final.
After we finished, I let out a scream and sort of just lay down in the boat and passed out a little. That was every little thing I had in me. And I'm very glad I had every little thing, because that boat we beat was not too far behind us.
So Anders and Narag are on their way to Rio. When races begin next weekend, Anders says their efforts and not their talent will determine their fate. Oh, and one more thing. That day back in May was the very first time Anders Weiss had ever listened to a podcast. And now?
Oh, I'm a podcast listener now. Yeah. Yes, I am. I'm going to keep listening to them till I die.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Next week on the show, the amazing and little-known backstory of the last Olympic rugby champion. Hint, it was the U.S. back in 1924. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a former Major League All-Star tells a trade deadline tale that involves stress, relocation, and a fantasy fulfilled. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Say, you're in Philadelphia. What did you make of Michael Jordan's speech at the DNC?
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has got one of the great sly senses of humor of all time, because he delivered that line completely deadpan.
For our listeners who weren't watching the DNC that night, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar came out and said, "Hi, I'm Michael Jordan, and I'm with Hillary Clinton." And the reason he could say that, according to him, was he said Donald Trump wouldn't know the difference.
That's exactly right.
In advance of the trade deadline, Charlie, baseball teams have been making trades. Have the Cubs locked up the championship by acquiring Aroldis Chapman, he of the 100-plus mile-an-hour fastball?
They've locked up certainly a better chance than just about any other team in baseball, and they've certainly locked up attendance, because he's one of the guys you go see.
Should the Cubs be worried that when reporters asked Chapman if team officials had mentioned expectations about his off-field behavior, Chapman said he couldn't remember?
Yeah, I think they should be, because I think that what we're discussing, which is an allegation of domestic violence, that's not something you should forget. So there should be a quiver in the liver on that one.
Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred has indicated that at their next meeting, the owners are going to consider a shorter schedule, and they'll also probably suggest that if they play fewer games, the players should be paid less. Those negotiations should go well, don't you think?
The players will gladly take fewer games. I will gladly take fewer games.
Me
I think
too.
The season would be better at 154. But they're not going to take less money for playing less games. What, are you mad?
The real Michael Jordan is donating $1 million to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and $1 million to an organization dedicated to strengthening relations between communities and police. I wonder if this is in response to the criticism, long-time criticism, that he's always stayed away from involvement in social issues.
You know, it's hard to say. It is interesting, though, that now he's an owner and he has to deal with athletes who are involved in these issues. It's also probably a way of signaling to younger players, look, I'm with you people. I'm somebody you can talk to about these things.
The famous ice bucket challenge, in which people, among those people, lots and lots of athletes, raised money for medical research by dumping ice on each other's heads, has produced results. According to an article in Nature Genetics, the money the challenge raised has resulted in the discovery of a new ALS gene, and this may advance the understanding of how to treat ALS. This would be enough to encourage me to dump ice on your head if you were in the studio today.
Maybe we should do that down the line. We'll have a live ice bucket challenge.
Can we do it on a day like we've had this week?
Yeah,
where the thermometer is over 90?
We're not going to be doing the ice bucket challenge in February, no.
By the time we talk next week, the Rio Olympics will be underway.
Why? Why must they be?
They have to be. In the lead-up, obviously, all kinds of controversies. But when the games begin, what do you think? Will we forget all the controversies the way people seem to always do?
Unfortunately, I think we'll forget most of them. But I think there'll be constant reminders, considering that the latest story is that the athletes' village is a hellhole. You know, you will hear these things. Now, whether you will hear them on American television is a whole other matter.
The U.S. Women's Eight has won 10 straight World or Olympic rowing titles. They'll be trying to make it 11 in Rio. And you thought the U.S. men's basketball team was dominant.
Yeah, that's quite a story. And, of course, I mean, not to continue to be a downer about this, but considering that this time they're going to be rowing through sewage and body parts, I think this may be the most remarkable championship of all.
Well, it may be a greater challenge.
Exactly.
And I'm sure they'll be up to it.
I mean, I know that when you miss a stroke, it's called catching a crab. But I don't think catching an arm has ever entered the lexicon.
NFL training camps are opening all around this grateful nation. Are you preparing to attend the camps and the exhibition games in all their dazzling, sweltering glory?
I suspect I'll turn up at one or the other. The hottest place I have ever been in my life, and I include Qatar in this, was Wichita Falls, where Dallas used to train. It was surface of mercury hot. I know that you'll be firing up the RV.
Oh, yeah.
To go driving around Wisconsin to the various camps.
Oh, yeah. Now, wait a minute. I'm looking at the football news here, and it says Tom Brady won't be playing the first four games of the season. What's up with that?
We are not going down that rabbit hole. You cannot take me there.
Warren Sapp, who had a Hall of Fame career as a defensive tackle in the NFL, suffered an injury that he never could have suffered on the field. A lot of bad things can happen to football players, but they just aren't often bitten by sharks.
Yeah, that is quite something. He was fishing. Lobster fishing, actually.
Lobster fishing, yeah.
And apparently a pretty good-sized nurse shark looked up and said, lunch.
After which Mr. Sapp said, dinner, because he had the lobsters. I mean,
you got to love him. He did land the lobster despite being bitten by a shark.
Finally, Charlie, the celebration of the Cleveland Cavaliers, winners of the NBA championship, just goes on and on. At the Ohio State Fair, the American Dairy Association unveiled the Larry O'Brien Trophy carved out of butter, as well as butter sculptures of the Cavaliers mascots, Moondog and Sir CC. It's been a hot summer, as we've established. I'm not sure this was such a good idea.
Well, no, they keep them in nice refrigerated glass cases. Because of my other gig in writing politics, I have seen the butter cow at the Iowa State Fair more than anybody should in one lifetime. So I'm sure that the butter mascots and the butter Larry O'Brien trophy will be perfectly wonderful.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
If you're a major league ball player, you live with the possibility that you'll be traded. And for lots of players, that possibility becomes much more likely as the midsummer trade deadline approaches.
You start to read about possible trade rumors, and then when you see your name pop up, that's when you start to really, you know, think about it and talk to your wife about it. What if we got traded here? What if we got traded there?
That's former slugger and first baseman Sean Casey. Toward the end of his 12-year major league career, he got traded a lot. He recalls one transaction with great glee. It happened 10 years ago, right at the Major League trade deadline, which, by the way, is coming up on Monday. Casey was employed by the Pittsburgh Pirates, and the team had just demonstrated their appreciation by staging Sean Casey Bobblehead Night.
It was a sold-out crowd. I didn't play that night because they knew I was going to get traded. They didn't want me to get hurt. You know, I live in Pittsburgh now. I still have people that say, man, I can't believe we're at your bobblehead night. You didn't even play. I'm like, yeah, I was traded. I think I got traded the next day.
Casey welcomed the trade, which sent him to the Detroit Tigers, where he'd be playing for the very successful Jim Leland, known as a player's manager. But like almost all trades, this one came with some complications more significant than a bobblehead night minus the star attraction.
We just bought a house, and that day, it just turns out the day they were leaving, we were closing on our house. And Jim Leland calls me, you know, he gets the old, you know, it sounded like he just smoked a couple cigarettes. He's like, hey, Case, I just want to tell you, so excited to have you. And he's like, can you meet us in Tampa for the game tonight? I'm like, oh, 100% Skip, I'll meet you in Tampa tonight. I'll be there for the game. So I went and told my wife, I was like, listen, good luck closing on the house. Luckily, we got through that together. We still live in that house, too. 10 years later, we still live in the house she closed on.
When he reached Tampa, Casey was delighted to learn that Leland remembered that the guy he'd just acquired lacked at least one of the tools necessary to a great player.
You know, I was never known for my speed, and Leland comes over and grabs me at when I'm at the lockers. Hey, I need to talk to you. And he's like, all right, Casey. He's like, we're going to give you the sign. So he's like, you get on first base with a single or a walk, look in the dugout to me. He goes, when we catch eyes, stay with me. If I jump up and never come back down, you steal.
Playing for Jim Leland wasn't the only benefit in being traded to the Tigers. Whereas the Pirates were an also-ran, the Tigers were in first place. Casey was thrilled with the opportunity to join a contender.
Oh, my gosh. You kidding me? You know, I went from the outhouse to the penthouse and, you know, one phone call. Here I am. Next thing I know, I'm in the middle of a pennant race. To beat the Yankees that first round was unbelievable. We swept Oakland in the second round, getting to the World Series. The dream is to get to the big leagues, but the dream within the dream is that a home run in the World Series. And, you know, rounding first base, feeling like that little kid in the backyard playing wiffle ball, you know, giving the old, and Sean Casey homers in the World Series when you're 12. I hit two home runs in that World Series. It was like a dream come true.
That World Series ended when the St. Louis Cardinals beat the Tigers 4-1. Nobody could blame Sean Casey for that result. He went 9-for-17 in the 5 games and led Detroit with 5 runs batted in. A couple of years later, after stints with a total of 5 teams, Casey retired. In terms of geography alone, it had been a long and winding road.
I'd stay in Jupiter, Florida in the offseason, go to spring training, and usually when Sarasota was with the Reds or wherever I was in, Lakeland or Bradenton or Fort Myers with the Red Sox for 7 weeks, and then you'd go get a house in like Detroit or Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and then you just continued to do that for 12 years, and it was crazy.
For Sean Casey, that particular craziness ended after the 2008 season. For a lot of players, the last year in the big leagues marks the beginning of a difficult transition. It doesn't sound as if Sean Casey had that problem.
You know, I got 4 kids at home, and I have this great job up at MLB Network that I love. I hadn't taken a summer vacation since I was like 18 till I was 34 when I retired. We're getting ready to go to the Jersey Shore for a couple weeks, so it's always nice to kind of live a normal life where you can enjoy the summers with your family.
And enjoy baseball, even at this time of year, because you don't have to worry about getting a phone call from your boss telling you that you've been traded to Milwaukee, or Seattle, or New York, or Miami, or Chicago, or St. Louis, or Philadelphia, or Cleveland. When Alan Siegel finished college in 1960, he wasn't planning on creating iconic sports logos, but he did. You've surely seen them. They're still in use today. Alan Siegel tells his story in his own words.
When I graduated from Cornell, I didn't have the remotest idea of what to do with my life, so I decided to go to law school. Law school was depressing and difficult. I was living at home, and my mom was dying of cancer, and when my mother passed away, I took a leave of absence and never thought about it again. So I got my papers and volunteered to go into the Army right away. I was stationed for 2 years in central Germany in a small rural town called Butzbach, which is about 40 miles north of Frankfurt. We had 300,000 troops in central Germany, and the American troops completely overwhelmed the local population. And our job was to be ready for an invasion from the east. And Germany was still staggering, you know, from the Second World War. The roads were cobblestone. My first instinct is I wanted to record the experience that I had. The first photo I took that I remember was a farmer plowing a field right outside of the base that I was on with 2 oxen. And then I went to the PX and I bought a Pentax camera and a couple of lenses. I almost had it with me all the time. There was this wonderful man who ran the photography lab, and most of the GIs were taking pictures in Scandinavia of naked girls and doing crazy things. And I was started doing landscapes and doing portraits of the German people and the farmers and so on. And he saw what I was doing, and he taught me how to develop film and how to print. And he was a real artisan. I had a car. He'd never been in a car before. We drove around the German countryside and did photography together. And so I began to see that I was really a creative person, that photography stimulated some dormant creativity and passion I had for the visual arts and basically changed my life. I took a job at a design firm. One of the clients I handled was Major League Baseball. They were having their 100th anniversary, and they needed a logo. So they came to this firm that I was working at, and I developed with my team the logo for Major League Baseball, which is still used today, which is the silhouette of the hitter. It's in blue, red, and white. The baseball player has a hat on, and it has a lot of, you know, it has that tension of him ready to strike at the ball. I left to set up my own firm a number of years after that. I had been in business a year, and I had a small office on 52nd Street. The NBA came to see me. I remember everything about that project because the firm was so new. Professional basketball didn't have the allure, you know, 45 years ago that it has today. And the NBA was having a lot of trouble with their reputation because of drugs and other issues. And the league was kind of faltering, and it needed an uplift. Major League Baseball was the great American game, so Commissioner Kennedy wanted the National Basketball Association have a graphic representation which had the same power and modernity and styling that was so successful with the baseball logo. I found that picture of Jerry West driving down the court and use it, that silhouette, as the essence of the logo. It's a picture of Jerry West dribbling up the court. It has a rhythm to it because you can sort of see his body leaning. It was very clear to me that that was the had the right feel to it. So I did the design maybe in 20 or 40 minutes. I went back to him in 4 days, showed it to them, and it was accepted and used. It was a nice project for a young firm to have done. I had no idea that it would have the visibility and success that it has today. And what's amazing about it to me is that wherever I go, they introduce me as the guy who did the NBA logo. And I guess people respect it, so that makes me feel good. I'm lucky because most people don't find their passion, you know, and I found my passion through photography.
Alan Siegel founded the strategic branding firm Siegel & Gale. He's the author of the book Simple and a Collector of Photography. You can find a link to the photo that inspired Siegel's design for the NBA logo at onlyagame.org. Our story was produced by Martin Kessler. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and from Bob Schaefer. Our intern is Ian Foster, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Father Joe Young's ferocious guard dog, Moses. What? What's that, Moses? There once was a priest up in Limerick who... Hey, now wait just a minute. I can't tell that on the air. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more Sports NPR style on Only a Game. And thank you for listening.